The Path of Compassion by G. de Perucre. Page 14, Chapter 3. The Still, Small Path. All esoteric schools have taught as the very foundation of their being, man, know thyself. It has ever been thus, and the key to this lies in many things. It lies in the study of the suffering that the knot of personality experiences before its intricate labyrinth of selfishness is overpassed. It lies also on a more exoteric plane, in the perusal of the majestic literatures of past ages. The brain work, the heart work, the work of the soul, of the seers and sages of every era. Greatest of all, it lies in the study of love for others and utter forgetfulness of self. Therein rests the mystery of Buddhahood, of Christhood. Forgetfulness of self, absorption in love, all-encompassing, unbounded, frontierless, of all that is. Some people imagine that the path of spiritual attainment is far away over the mountains of the future, almost unreachable, when in reality there is relatively narrow frontier between ordinary life and that followed by the neophyte or chela. Essentially, the difference is one of outlook and not of metaphysical distance. It is the same difference that exists between the one who falls under the sway of temptation and thereafter becomes its bondslave, and the other who successfully resists the temptation and thereafter becomes its master. Anyone can enter upon the path if his will, his devotion and yearnings are directed toward being of greater service to others. The only thing that prevents him from taking that most beautiful step is his convictions, his psychological and mental prejudices which distort his perspective. We are all learners. All of us have illusions. Even the Mahatmas and adepts have illusions, albeit of an extremely subtle and lofty character, which prevent them from going still higher. And this is one of the reasons they are so compassionate towards those who are seeking to tread the very path along which they have successfully advanced in former days. The quickest way to overcome these illusions is to cut the root of them, and that root is selfishness in its multi-myriad forms. Even the yearning for advancement, when it is for self alone, is based on selfishness, which in turn produces its own subtle and powerful mayas. Therefore, every ambition to succeed, unless it be washed clean of all personality, will inevitably defeat itself. For the way of inner growth is self-forgetfulness, a giving up of personal ambition and longings of any and every kind, and becoming an impersonal servitor of all that lives. It should be stated, however, that the purpose of genuine occultism is not to produce disciples or to turn refractory human material into individuals striving for mere self-advancement. Rather, is it to regenerate our imperfect human nature into becoming at first nobly human and finally godlike. And this along the archaic and traditional lines of teaching and discipline which have been recognized and followed for ages past. Chelaship is a vision out of which arise conviction and definite action. All the rules of moral conduct that one may read about in the great literatures of the ancient philosophies, as well as in theosophical writings, are simply powerful aids to help the aspirant cleanse himself of selfishness. The real code of ethics is an unwritten one, and therefore not subject to dogmatisms, not easily enslaved to conventional notions or misconstruction by minds debating and quarreling about mere words. In essence, it is of the extremest simplicity, for the most beautiful and the most comprehensive truths are always the simplest. There are times when I throw my pen aside and say to myself, "Let us have just the simple truths that the little ones with their unspoiled natures and their direct and quick perception can grasp." It is difficult permanently to deceive a child. But when it is said that the neophyte must regain the child state, this does not mean childishness or stupidity. It is the child's heart that we need, trusting, intuitive, and alert. Intellectual training is very valuable and a great help, but to become as a little one is the most difficult lesson for human beings to learn. The brain-mind is a good instrument when guided and trained, but is a tyrant when left to its own devices and impulses, for it is always selfish. Its vision is necessarily limited to the swirl of the lower and restricted field of consciousness of the monistic knot of personality. In the higher nature lies the higher understanding, and it alone can arrive at the inner meaning of the teachings. The lower mind can achieve some success in the brain-mind comprehension of them, but only when helped from the inner understanding. An individual may be quite sincere, quite willing to know, quite ready to experiment and to investigate, but the Buddhic splendor may be completely absent. The only test of fitness is that which is given by the individual himself. If the light of Buddhi be shining, even by so much as a fugitive glimmer, that is enough. There is then in that individual the esoteric right to know. Self-conquest is the path of growth. The whole truth is contained in these few simple words. It is a slow growth, as with all great things. And if it is to be attained, it must be the unfolding of the man himself. There is no other path than that of inner development, no easy way. The one who cannot control himself in the affairs of daily life, and does not know who or what he is, cannot control the events and experiences that inevitably arise around anyone who succeeds, even in small degree, in approaching that straightest of all gates. Here is a strange paradox. If one would be master of himself, he must be utterly selfless. And yet, he must be himself utterly. The lower self must be wiped out, not killed, but wiped out, which means withdrawn inwards and absorbed by the higher self. For the higher self is our essential or real being, and the lower is but a ray therefrom, soiled, rendered unclean, so to say, because it becomes attached to this world of multi-myriad illusions. The man most easily deceived is the man most enfolded in Maya, and such are often the so-called worldly wise. You cannot deceive an adept, as he would instantly see the attempt at deception, and the reason is that you cannot, as it were, throw hooks of personal attachment into his being. Nothing one can do or say will affect him or attract him to your thought if it is in the slightest degree selfish, non-universal. He is above those illusions, has fought through them, found them out, and rejected them. Yet the masters feel, even before we ourselves would realize it, the slightest moving of the true Chela spirit. The call upon them is tremendous, and a quick, magnetic sympathy is thereupon established. Taking the thought a step further, when a neophyte makes a deliberate and actual choice with all the strength of his being, he kindles a light within, and this is the Buddhic splendor. And, as said, it is sensed understandingly and watched and cared for by the teachers, and thus he is an accepted chela. How long will he remain such? None is picked out by perambulating magicians wandering the world, selecting whom they may think to be proper material. Not at all. The choice is in the individual. He chooses his path, he makes his resolve, and if the Buddhic light is seen, be it only a spark, he is accepted, although that fact may be unknown to himself for the time being. Thereafter all depends upon him, whether he succeed or fall by the wayside. It is a matter of the rarest occurrence for one immediately to know that he has been accepted. For the usual rule is that he is tested in 100,000 different ways. These tests arising out of the ordinary events of life and the aspirant's reactions to them. Once, however, that he becomes cognizant of his teacher, the path becomes both easier and more difficult. easier because there is the new conviction that at least a certain success has been attained, and also because of the courage and self-confidence that arise out of this fact. Vastly more difficult because from now on he is under more direct training and guidance, and small lapses and little backslidings, for which large indulgence is allowed in the beginning, have henceforth very serious consequences. Moreover, no teacher makes himself known to his disciple without the latter's having previously received many instructive premonitions from his own inner being. The reason is clear. No one ever becomes accepted until he has actually been accepted by his own inner divinity, that is, until he has become more or less aware of the stirring within him of a wondrous mystery. A certain stage of progress is of course necessary before such a choice can be made, but every normal being can make such a choice. Because in him spirit and matter have attained a more or less stable equilibrium. In other words, chelaship may be undertaken at any stage by anyone who can arouse the Christ light in his mind and heart. His resignation of the lower selfhood on the altar is what counts, and no human cry for help ever passes unheard if that cry for light be impersonal. The test is impersonality. Let us not imagine, however, that because the words renunciation and sacrifice are often used, these imply the loss of anything of value. On the contrary, instead of a loss, it is an indescribable gain, to give up the things that belittle, that make one small, petty, and mean, is to cast away our fetters and take on freedom, the richness of the inner life, and above everything else, self-conscious recognition of one's essential unity with the All. It should be clearly understood that this training, which is one of study and of discipline, arising in the spiritual and intellectual movements of the student's own soul, has never included, and never will include, any interference with or encroachments upon his family rights or duties. Chelaship is nothing weird, nothing queer or erratic. If it were, it would not be chelaship. It is the most natural path for us to strive to follow, for by allying ourselves with the noblest within, we are allying ourselves with the spiritual forces which control and govern the universe. There is inspiration in the thought. The neophyte's life is a very beautiful one, and grows steadily more and more so as self-forgetfulness comes into the life in ever larger degree. It is also a very sad one at times, and the sadness arises out of his inability to forget himself. He realizes that he is very, very lonely, that his heart is yearning for companionship. In other words, the human part of him longs to lean. But it is just the absence of these weaknesses that makes the master of life. The ability to stand alone, erect and strong in all circumstances. But never think that the Mahatmas are dried-up specimens of humanity, without human feelings or human sympathy. The contrary is the case. There is a far quicker life in them than in us, a far stronger and more pulsing vital flow. Their sympathies are enlarged so greatly that we could not even understand them, although some day we shall. Their love encompasses all, they are impersonal, and therefore are they becoming universal. Chelaship means trying to bring out the Master living in our own being, for he is there now. There will come a time, however, if one progress far enough, when even the family duty will have to be dropped. But the circumstances then will be such that the dropping will actually be a benediction to the individual as well as to the one towards whom the duty formerly lay. Yet let no one be deceived by the dangerous doctrine that the higher a man goes, the less he is bound by the moral law. The direct converse of this is the truth. The doing of wrong to another is never right. At no step along the sublime path is there ever exterior compulsion of any kind. Only such lofty compulsion as springs forth from the aspirant's own yearning soul to advance ever farther and farther inwards and upwards forever. Each step is marked, during its earlier course, by dropping something of the personal shackles and imperfections which keep us enchained in these realms of matter. We are told with reiterated insistence that the grandest rule of life is to foster within one's own being a dying compassion for all that is, thus bringing about the winning of selflessness, which in its turn enables the peregrinating monad ultimately to become the self of the cosmic spirit without loss to the monad of its individuality. In the above lies the secret of progress. To be greater, one must become greater. To become greater, one must abandon the less. To encompass a solar system in one's understanding and life, one must give up, which means outgrow and surpass the limits of personality of the mere human. By abandoning the lower selfhoods, we pass into the larger selfhoods of selflessness. No one will progress a single step to the more expanded selfhood, which already is his own higher nature, until he learns that living for self means descending into still more compacted and restricted spheres, and that living for all that is means an expansion of his own soul into becoming the larger life. All the mysteries of the universe lie latent within us. All its secrets are there, and all progress in esoteric knowledge and wisdom is but an unfolding of what is already within. How little are human troubles which plague us so greatly, such a burden of sorrow, seeing when we allow our minds to dwell upon these infinitely comforting realities. No wonder the Christian writer declared that not even a sparrow falleth from heaven without its being known to the divine. Not even a hair of our heads but is counted and cared for. How much more so than we ourselves? Even this world of phantasmagoria and shadows is an intrinsic and inseparable part of the boundless from which we sprang, and towards the divine heart of which we shall some day return on the wings of the experiences that we have been through, wings that will carry us over the valleys to the distant mountain peaks of the Spirit.